Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things English Football Pyramid. On today's episode, is pressure starting to mount on Mikel Arteta with another loss in Milan midweek? What is going on at Manchester City after a third defeat in a row? We'll have a preview of the big Premier League games at the weekend, including Liverpool, Aston Villa and Chelsea, Arsenal. We'll have a roundup of the EFL action, including commentary's decision to sack Mark Robbins. And we'll finish with Lauro, who talks through Yeovil's upcoming fixture at Roots Hall against Southend. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, once again I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Boys, we want to start at Arsenal. Lost in Milan on Wednesday, obviously lost at Newcastle at the weekend. Arteta starting to come under some pressure with his style of play as well. Fans starting to call out that they're a bit route one and one dimensional. Laurie, do you think he's starting to come under a fair bit of pressure now?
Yeah, I think if you want to operate as a club that is expected to do well in Europe and at the title end of the Premier League, then if you go through a run of form like they've been on, then you are going to be subject to increasing pressure every time that you don't win a football match. And although we've spoken about the injuries before, I think there's a train of thought within Arsenal fans that they're a little bit workmanlike and not overly good to watch, and a lot of their goals come from sort of set pieces, and a lot of the games they win by one goal, and that's fine as long as you're challenging at the top of the league. But as soon as you drop off and all of a sudden you're fourth and fifth, you've still got a couple of players out and you don't know where your next win's coming from, and it looks like you're sort of getting pushed further and further out of the title race. And we were just chatting off air, it's actually 5 years since Mikel Arteta took over at Arsenal. Then, yes, I think he will be, rightly or wrongly, start to have his job questioned more and more in the coming weeks. So they need a couple of wins back-to-back to bounce back from this terrible run of form. But I think Gary Neville said in the week he expects Arsenal to win the title still. He thinks that every team has to go through this kind of blip that catapults them and maybe acts as a catalyst for them to go on. And if you can capture form sort of after Christmas going into March, April, particularly this year where I don't think the competition's quite as good. There's more of it because Liverpool are involved, but I don't think Man City are quite going to do what they've been doing in recent years after Christmas. There might be a chance for them to come back. But Arteta obviously needs to make sure he's in a job for that. I expect he will be, but he's definitely under pressure from, I think, the fans, and you never know, maybe even the hierarchy at Arsenal.
Tomo, obviously, he won the FA Cup in the 1920 season, as we were just discussing off air, and recently spoke with Lauro and a couple of the lads about how, you know, Erik ten Hag is probably going to go down as one of the worst Manchester United managers. But actually, from a trophy perspective, he's had the League Cup and he's had the FA Cup. And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek to compare the two, to say he's won more trophies than Arteta, so therefore he's done better, because there's obviously a clearer style of play and setup at Arsenal. But do you think the Arsenal hierarchy are going to be starting to think, we need to start turning some of these kind of Premier League campaigns and these cup runs into actual trophies?
Yeah, I do think they're going to be thinking that, but I don't for one second think he's going to be under any sort of pressure. But I read reports this morning saying, like we speak about the sporting director, Edu, there having quite a close relationship with Mikel Arteta, and obviously he's just left. And I read reports this morning saying that Mikel Arteta is going to have a big say in who the next sporting director is. And if that's to be believed, then obviously they plan on moving forward with Arteta at the helm. And yeah, it's difficult because obviously as football fans, like, winning trophies is so important, yet for 99% of the season last year, maybe even 99.5% of the season last year, it was miserable as a Man United fan. Do you know what I mean? And if you ask Arsenal fans, for most of the season, they were happy with how things were going, happy with the progress, happy with what they were seeing on the pitch. It just so happened that they fell at the last hurdle to an unbelievable Man City team who went on one of their runs that they usually go on after Christmas. So, but like Laura alludes to, like you allude to, obviously if this continues, then the pressure will build. I do have a little bit of sympathy for Arteta and in the style of play, because they've been without their best creative force this whole, for most of the season, and although that's what squads are for, you are supposed to be able to replace the likes of Odegaard's their best player for a reason. You can't just sort of bring on the bench player and expect him to do the same job that Odegaard does. So, and what's happened is they've brought in a Marino or someone like that, and they've had to change the way they play. And apart from the last, I think they've lost three of the last four games now, but apart from those, this little patch that most teams go through, even Man City are going through, they've been managing to win the games, even though they're not playing that well. And they just need to get back on track, start winning the games. And obviously Odegaard's on his way back now as well. So it's not all doom and gloom, even though obviously it is a blip.
Yeah, I think when you're judging a manager, it is really the most important thing is to sort of zoom out and look at the graph and look at the trajectory. And I think Arteta and Arsenal, the general trend is up, isn't it? And I think if you ask most people where Arsenal will be in 3 years' time, I think a lot of people would expect that they'd have more trophies in the cabinet than they have in the last 5 years. So that's the most important thing. But when we talk about pressure on Arteta, that doesn't necessarily mean to say under pressure for his job. Like, he's under pressure from the fans to turn the results around at the moment. You're always going to get that at big clubs. And the longer it goes on, the more it can snowball. And then you can end up with ridiculous decisions at some point. So it's just something that will probably be in the back of the mind at the moment. But I don't think anyone would argue that, obviously, Arteta's doing a good job. And regardless of the style of play, I mean, I hate watching Man City play, but no one's gonna complain about what Pep's done there if you're a Man City fan over the last few years. So it's not all about that. We're just in a low point for Arsenal at the moment in what's been a really good couple of seasons.
You spoke about Gary Neville saying he still expects Arsenal to win the league. I think he'll make a point at the start of the season and he'll hold that point right until it's no longer viable. I think he had one, maybe it was the year before, where he was like, I don't think Arsenal will win the league. And he turned out to be right with it. But there's a real possibility with Arsenal going to Chelsea this weekend, with Chelsea obviously picking up form. Liverpool have got a tough fixture themselves in Villa, but one that I do expect them to win, where Arsenal find themselves 11 points behind. And the past couple of seasons, I know it's been Man City hunting them down, but it's been a case of Arsenal being ahead in the title race. And then can they hold their nerve? 11 points behind, regardless of if you're in November, is a lot of points with how teams are looking. And I know it's not Man City and it's Liverpool, Tomo, but that is a lot of points to be behind in a title race.
Yeah, but no one's sitting here saying that Arsenal or Mikel Arteta will be happy about that or satisfied with that. But I think, like Laura's mentioned, over the last five seasons, he's gained up enough credit in the bank to be able to go through a period like this. Without, I know social media is a big thing, but really, the match-going fans are probably the ones you want to be listening to, and I'm sure they all back him. You watch like Arsenal fan TV; some of them kick off, and some of them are calling for Arteta's head. But quite often, that's just for views and just for hoping to go viral. But yeah. Look, there just needs to be like Laura says: just take a step back, zoom out, and yes, this is a blip. On that trajectory, but over the last five seasons, it's been going up and up and up every single year. And even if this year they don't win the big one, but they qualify for the Champions League, and it's just a sort of a minor blip. Obviously, I would say, look, stick with him, stick with the plan, stick with the process. What I will say is, I wonder if this is a... Because when Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp went up head-to-head, toe-to-toe with Man City over the course of that 4 or 5 year period, there was a couple seasons in there where they dropped off. And I wonder if it is just a marker of how hard it is to compete with Pep Guardiola's Man City time and time again, year and year again. And maybe this might be a year where they just drop off their level and they might have to come again next year. But I do think it's too early for that that conclusion to be made. But it is just difficult to compete with City at the top. And we'll probably come on to City in a bit because they're going through a blip themselves.
Yeah, no, nice segue into that. And one final point is I'm making the assumption there that Arsenal could be 11 points behind. That will mean Liverpool will have to beat Villa and Arsenal lose at Chelsea. You know, sometimes we make predictions on these pods and the exact opposite happens. In fact, quite often that happens. There's a possibility that Liverpool drop points against Villa and Arsenal go and pick up a win at Chelsea and suddenly it's 5 points or 7 points, and it's not looking quite as bad. So yeah, we'll some big weekend fixtures there, which we'll talk about in a little bit more detail later. But Tomo, yeah, Man City, really good point. Last time we spoke, they just lost to Tottenham, and it looked like Pep had kind of taken his foot off the gas a bit with the League Cup, and there's sort of Haaland left on the bench and smiling at full time. But since then, Laurie, we've had them lose at Bournemouth in the league, and then they got mullered in Lisbon in the week by Ruben Amorim, who's obviously coming in at Man United Sporting Lisbon. Three losses in a row now for City. Probably not something Pep's had to deal with too many times in his career.
Yeah. What did I say last week? I said the loss to Tottenham and the way that it happened was a seismic moment in the landscape of English football. I wasn't doing that, you know, for clout. It was the way in which he said, we do not want to waste energy on this game. And what he's essentially saying is there, we don't want to put any energy into trying to win. And as soon as you sow that seed, I think you're going to, even if it's 0.5%, you are going backwards. And if you couple that with the fact that their best player in the Ballon d'Or winner is out for the season, I think that is a recipe for absolute, not disaster, but not being anywhere near as good or as forceful as they have been in recent years. And I said last week that I think if Arsenal lost to Newcastle, they'd be out of the title race. They did lose to Newcastle, but I'm just going to backtrack a little bit because I don't think there is going to be that team. We've got Man City, who I think are going to be weaker, and Liverpool are a bit of an unknown. They look really good, by the way, are my favourites now. But I think there might still be a door slightly ajar there to say that there isn't going to be a team that go and win 19 of the last 20 games of the season this year. And I think Rodri is obviously a massive blow, but Pep's just coming out and saying that out loud, saying we're not going to waste energy here. I just think psychologically it's just such a poor message to be given to a team that have been so relentless and got so much praise for how relentless and how they keep going, and it's how they keep rolling out these strings of performances and wins and runs of results year after year after year. Just to go and put a stopper on that, I think, for the Tottenham game last week, just to me, it just stood out to me as something that went, hang on a minute, that isn't quite right. They lost that game. They lost to Bournemouth. They got battered in Europe. And now they need to respond. So I'm sure they're not going to be losing every week. But I do think that is the start of maybe the other side of the Pep peak at City.
Just playing devil's advocate, Murph. If you cast your mind back to this time last year, Man City went on a six-game streak where they only won one of those games, and it was against Luton. It was a tough run of fixtures, but people basically were drawing the similar conclusions to last season. And obviously, they went on to do that 19 wins out of 20 or whatever it was in the second half of the season. And Laura makes a really good point that obviously without Rodri, that's the important bit of context here, is can they go on a run like that without basically their most important player? And maybe not. And you read some of the articles and you look through the Man City squad. Quite a lot of those players are sort of over the age of 29, 30 now. And it feels like the squad as a whole needs refreshing. And quite often, when you get these players who are over the age of 30, they're a little bit more injury prone. They can't play every 3 days like Rodri has been able to do. And like Haaland's been able to do. Obviously, Haaland's not over the age of 30. But it feels like the injuries are creeping in a little bit. And I wonder if that might continue over the course of the season. And if it does, and there is a tinge of almost like, because we're Man United fans, because we don't want Man City to win the league five years in a row, because it will sort of make the league feel a little bit like a farmers league. There is a tinge of almost, we're hoping this happens, but I am hopeful.
That period that you refer to last year, I think it was about this time last year, that was also without Rodri. Do you remember he got like a silly sending off? And like he missed, I think, a few games, and which coincided with that poor run of form. But he's not coming back this year. And I also said at the start of the season, it like might be a bit of hyperbole, but I think Kevin De Bruyne's finished in terms of having a real meaningful impact in the title race. Like he's always been quite injury prone, but he'll come in and he'll come back from being injured for a month and he'll like assist six and score seven in his next 10 games or something. That he didn't do that last season. Phil Foden did. he was the one that put his hand up kind of in this, probably from now to the end of the season, and was the best player or one of the best players in Europe. And he's not firing on all cylinders this year either. And I think if you look at Haaland's form over the last 5 or 6 games, that's fallen off a cliff. And I think he's not probably getting that. You can't just have Haaland. There needs to be 2 or 3 that are in really good form in forward areas for them. And I think they're lacking a little bit of creativity in those areas as well. Like you said, everyone's a year older. Gundogan's come back. He's definitely not quite the same player or of the same level of influence as he was before. Like I said, Foden's in and out of the team a little bit. I think the players in wide areas aren't as talented as they have been before. If you look at kind of Doku, and maybe a bit early to judge Savinho, but in years gone by when we've had Sterling and Mahrez and players like that, I really do think, and I agree, I am hopeful of this too, because I want to see someone else win the league. But I do genuinely think it. On top of the context of that remark from Pep last week, which I think sets a really poor kind of undertone into Man City, and it'll be really interesting to see how they respond. But it's more than just hope. There's science behind it. There's a rhyme behind the reason. And I really do think that I think they could end up finishing like not in the top two. I think I said that at the start of the season, but even more so now. I think you could easily see like Liverpool, Arsenal, City. But that's just me.
Tomo, do you think that in January they might go looking for a Rodri replacement like for the rest of the season, or maybe like someone to come in to add competition to that places? It feels like they signed Nunes from Wolves and that's not worked out. He seems to be playing like left mid, left wing at the minute. Calvin Phillips, we all know how that ended. Do you think Pep's going to be ruthless and say in January, we need to sign someone, obviously you're never going to get a Rodri level, but a very, very good holding midfielder that can come in and play the rest of the season if we want to challenge for Premier League and Champions League?
What I expect is for them to get a Julian Alvarez replacement, which is actually, I know they got a lot of money for him and probably it's hard to say no to that a lot of money, but they never replaced him. And he was so important to City last year because he's so versatile in that front line and he could play in behind Haaland, he could play instead of Haaland. And I feel like they never replaced him. So they'll definitely get someone to be almost like a Haaland backup. But they'll... they definitely need a defensive midfielder. I feel like a little bit that like Pep had this coming. And I don't want to wish an injury on any player ever, obviously. And Rodri is like... Well, he won the Ballon d'Or. He's a bit, in my opinion, deservedly so as well. But they bought Calvin Phillips 2-3 years ago and just never played him. And even in like League Cup or even in like the Champions League, in the lesser games, they just never rotated. And Rodri over the last 3 seasons just basically played every single game he's available for. So in terms of like lessening the risk of an ACL injury, almost it feels like they almost had this coming with Rodri. And now they're sort of reaping what they sow. But yeah, in answer to your question, I do think they'll go in the market in January. But I actually think more importantly, they'll be trying to get a Julian Alvarez replacement as opposed to a Rodri one.
I agree with that. I think a lot of their problems is in the forward areas. Like Kovacic is like kind of the replacement for Rodri. And I think Kovacic is quite a good player. He's not at the level of Rodri, but you're probably not going to go and sign someone that's that much better than Kovacic. I mean, you talk about a holding midfielder for Man City. No one really gets at City, do they? It's more of the player that strings everything together and knits up and starts the moves and is just that presence. I think Kovacic can do a good enough role there. It's in those forward areas, like Tigo said. So I think that's a good point. But it's just enhanced by the fact that their best player is out. And just remember, City only won the league by the skin of their teeth last season. It was literally, if Arsenal had beaten Villa at home last year, they'd have won the league. So it was the smallest, the finest of margins. And is that margin going to be the same way round without Rodri all season and with an underperforming front line?
I think one caveat as well with City is that you're in that team with Rodri, which we know is out for the season. De Bruyne is only just getting back fit. And we know he has his fitness concerns, but when he is playing, he's quality. You had the Ruben Dias and John Stones, which is arguably the starting centre-back partnership, are both out as well. They are a bit light at the minute. And people have said about Arsenal having key players missing in games. City definitely have got that as well. So, you know, there's nothing stopping Dias, Stones, Kevin De Bruyne coming back into that side and Kyle Walker's not been playing, adding him back into that side and suddenly they go back on a winning streak. But I think it's really interesting to see how that goes. And I'm intrigued with their upcoming fixture as well, because they go away to Brighton at 5:30 on Saturday, which is a tricky place to go. And then Spurs go to the Etihad. So, and then they've got Liverpool after international break following the Tottenham game. So really important few weeks coming up for City. Tomo, before we move on, I just want to touch on that Sporting game a little bit more detail. Obviously, Ruben Amorim's last game, home game and Champions League game for Sporting Lisbon, and probably his last Champions League game for a couple of years. How did you think they did? Obviously, they tend to set up in a back three. Do you think that's something that United are going to look to adapt and go to his style of play? And if so, just want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I certainly think he's going to come in and implement his formation. He's been a manager for, 5 years now, been at three clubs. Every single club he's managed has done this formation. It's quite flexible in that formation in terms of little nuances, etc. But it's always through at the back with two wing-backs. So, yeah. Do you know what I found quite interesting? Is like, and I was listening to the Talk of the Devils podcast here before I come on here, and they mentioned it was quite a good point that, you know, he got that kind of like that hero's ovation, like where all the players grab the manager and throw him up in the air. You rarely see that in the middle of the season when a manager's just almost sort of left you to your own devices.
Do you think there's a little bit with Tomo where they've like, he's like almost seen out these three games before the international break? It's not been like a clean sort of, yeah, I want to go to United, and you don't get the chance to manage another game. Like, it often for me is if a manager leaves to go to another club, he doesn't then take the next fixture with it. So you'd never see that chance for it to happen mid-season, where this has been a bit more of a transition where we've signed him, but he's almost agreed this 2-week extension, which has given him like almost like a 2-week honeymoon period to take the applause. That might be why we're seeing a bit more of a mid-season like love in for it.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. And obviously it's off the back of just beating Man City 4-1. And I watched that game, and to be honest, Ruben Amorim said after that they were quite lucky. And they were pretty lucky. They got absolutely battered in the first half. And then a couple of quick goals in the second half changed the game, and Haaland misses the penalty. If Haaland scored that penalty, I would probably back City to go on to at least get a point. So 4-1 definitely flattered Sporting, but it's hard not to get excited as a Man United fan, because you see the sort of images of Pep Guardiola looking forlorn and gutted on the sideline, and Amorim looking like he's the big boss. Do you know what I mean? So, and in terms of that 3-4-3 formation, I do think United, especially at the back with the likes of De Ligt, Martinez and Yoro, I do think these three players are suited to that back three. You've got Martinez, who's obviously a very talented player with the ball and tenacious off the ball, but is he physically up to it in terms of, I know it's lazy sort of analysis, but is he tall enough to be a centre-half in a two? Maybe not sometimes. And then you've got, obviously, De Ligt in that Maguire mould. Obviously, they're both brilliant centre-halves and brilliant defenders in the air, all of that sort of stuff, but are they quick enough to cover the ground in a two? So you can make arguments for why these players will suit. And obviously, when it comes to the wing-backs, you've got Diogo Dalot, who is good going forward, but he's so questionable defensively at times. So maybe having a sort of inside centre-half might help him. And the same goes for the likes of, that left-sided wing-back position. It'll be, I almost discount Luke Shaw as a player now, because he's just so injury prone.
Does he sometimes play a winger, Tomo, in those like wing-backs position? Like, do you think you're going to see like a Rashford or a Garnacho or something like that be told that they might have to play in a almost like a wing-back position?
My prediction is that Rashford will struggle. I do think there is scope for a Diallo or a Garnacho to play in that left wing position, left wing-back position, but I can't see Rashford doing it. He's too lazy off the ball. Garnacho's 19 and Amad Diallo, I think, is 21, 22. These guys can be moulded. Rashford's 27. Like, he is what he is now, which is a shame. But But yeah, but there's exciting times ahead. Like at the end of the day, as a United fan, you want that little bit of hope. And it did feel like over the last sort of 12 months, maybe even 18 months longer, that we've been just on a treadmill taking, like just running the same cycle every single week. Like, and there's been no sort of, as Lauro points out in the Arsenal analogy, if you zoom out, there's been, our trajectory's just been flat, if not downwards. So yeah, exactly. Apart from those big spikes when you win the League Cup or you win the FA Cup, it's been mostly downwards. So yeah, I'm hopeful that Ruben Amorim can come in and turn things around. Although, like I said in the last pod, Man United seems to swallow up these like really good players and these really good managers. And it just, like the job almost feels too big to handle. So, but you never know. Hopefully Ruben Amorim, he could be the next big thing. He could be the next Jose Mourinho coming out of Portugal. And it does feel a little bit like that after his send off on Wednesday.
You okay with this whole kind of work up until the international break and then coming over it? Or would you like him to have signed the deal and been in the dugout for Chelsea and in the Europa League and have the Leicester game before they go on international break?
No, I'm fine with it. Like I said in the last pod, it might have had something to do with like the financial compensation package.
Yeah.
But after listening to Amorim, it does feel like he's sort of pushed back a little bit. And I think he's developed a really strong relationship with the fans and the ownership and the players. And he's even openly admitted that he wanted to come at the end of the season. He wanted United to wait for him. And obviously United turned around and said, no, it's now or never. And I think this sort of three-game period is almost a halfway house where they've let Ruben Amorim go through these almost farewell matches. And then he's coming to United and starting the job in the international break, which is, you often see in the international breaks, managers of clubs get sacked and then they bring someone else in because it's almost a natural break in the season where you can reassess or restart and go again.
I'll be intrigued to see whether he just goes straight to a back three on that game against Ipswich, because he's going to have very little time with some starting players. If Ugarte was his man at Sporting and Lisandro Martinez is going to play, then they're going to be coming back from Argentina and Uruguay probably on the Wednesday, Thursday, ready for a Saturday, Sunday game against Ipswich. And there'll be other players that will be on international duty. So he's going to get very little time with them beyond the lads who've not been called up to international and some of the academy players. So I wonder if he's just going to put them straight into a 3-4-3 against Ipswich and just take it from there.
Yeah, but you got to give these players a little bit more credit in the sense of he's not playing a completely different sport. He's just changing the formation. Like these players, like they would have played in a back three time, like maybe a couple of times in their career. They would have trained with it quite a lot. It's not like, I know, yeah, it's a big adaptation, but you wouldn't just say, oh, we have to stick with a four because you guys aren't trained enough. It's like, no, give the players a bit of credit. They probably can adapt to the small change of playing three at the back instead of four. I fully expect him to come in and stamp his authority on the team and say, look, this is the way my teams play.
One group of players maybe you could say you shouldn't give too much credit to is the current United crop, though. They can't seem to play in any formation. So, but yeah, we will see. He's due in after the international break, and obviously we'll follow that very, very closely. Just before we move on to the weekend fixtures, Laurie, just want to ask you about Spurs. So they lost in Galatasaray last night, 3-2. They lost recently to Crystal Palace, but in between then they've beaten Man City and Hamid Aston Villa. Sometimes sort of see these peaks and troughs of Big Ange is under a bit of pressure and then Big Ange is, you know, doing well. Do you think, similar to conversation around Arteta, that there's anything on that or anything growing with him on that from a pressure point of view?
No, not really. I think they're seventh in the league. They'll be well in the... I mean, they're only 2 points off fourth. They had a really, really good result against a highly respected Villa at the moment. We watched the game last night, didn't we? Galatasaray are a good side. Really good side. And some of the Spurs players that have played, I'd never even heard of, like the guy that got sent off up front. So, no, I don't think there's mounting pressure on Big Ange at the moment. If he goes and loses you know, 6 out of 8 or something, then I'm sure there will be. But again, I think he's a manager that's got the trust of his bosses and his hierarchy at the moment. I think he's probably buys himself more time with the fact that they're enjoyable to watch. And I think Spurs have probably got their better days in this season ahead of them rather than behind them. Whereas this time last season, it was the opposite, wasn't it? They flew out of the traps last year, and I think they were top of the league for a while, and then suddenly got a load of suspensions and injuries and tailed off. We might actually see a good run of form from Tottenham in the league, I think, coming up, particularly after that performance against Villa, where they pretty much blew them away against the Villa side that everyone's talking about being sort of almost up towards the really big boys in the league and who have been playing really well and actually started that game okay as well. Took the lead and looked quite solid, but couldn't deal with Spurs late on. So, I think Ange's fine at Tottenham at the moment.
I'm going to make a couple of points and I want you boys to react to it because... So, he plays a couple of the youngsters in Galatasaray in Istanbul, like one of the most renowned hostile atmospheres ever, and he's so dogmatic in his sort of style of play. And this is actually more a general point about managers like Ange, who are so dogmatic in their style of play. Clearly, if you're going to play like your youngsters, is it not more beneficial to sort of almost? It feels a little bit old fashioned to go away in Europe and just hunker down and try and nick a win. Do you know what I mean? And he's just gone there. And I watched that. I watched the game, and they could have been battered like 7, 8, 9. It was ridiculous, the game. And they just kept giving the ball away, trying to play out from the back. And you almost admire it on one hand, but then you just think it's absolutely ridiculous. You're almost ruining these players' like experiences of one of the toughest and hardest atmospheres in the world, really. And they're just, you're not giving them any chance to go and win that game. So I think if there is any criticism, it's of the philosophy in general. And it's not just Ange, just the likes of like Russell Martin and it's like Vincent Kompany, all these guys. It's almost old fashioned now to almost play a different style of football based on where you're playing, who you're playing, all of this sort of stuff.
I think a caveat of that is that we've always had this kind of perception that if you play on Thursday night, you struggle at the weekend. And going away to Turkey is like renowned for being somewhere difficult to go. Spurs had won their first 3 Europa League games on 9 points. I think, Tomo, you've said mathematically 10 points guarantees you to go through. We've spoken about this, that it's harder not to qualify than to qualify. So from a big Ange perspective, he's probably thinking we've beaten Villa at the weekend, got one eye on the Ipswich game at the weekend. If we can rotate a couple out and give a couple of these boys an experience in a competition that we're now already qualified in, then, you know, that's the right thing to do. And let's have it right. That lad got sent off, that Will Lankshear, but he also scored to equalise. And, you know, at that point, you're thinking, bloody hell, what an experience for him to get a goal in Turkey on his European debut, so or second European game. So I think it's just one of them where he probably saw it as a bit of a free hit already on 9 points in a competition that you know they're going to qualify in.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm just harking back to like the United days. I remember once we were in the Champions League. I can't remember what year it was. We played Valencia, and we just sat back, literally just sat back for like 85 minutes, and then Chicharito. Yeah, Chicharito scored, and it was like it was almost dressed up as this like amazing away performance in Europe, but we let Valencia have the ball and we just sort of played like a Sean Dyche team would. Do you know what I mean? And it feels like that sort of going away from modern football where like all these managers have got philosophies and they stick to it and they're very dogmatic to this philosophy, yet quite often that like sticking to your philosophy like that vehemently will lose you the game. And okay, you are right. They probably did think last night was a free hit. So maybe the example of that game in particular doesn't ring true. But overall, I think we are seeing that trend in football where like managers are just sticking to their philosophy to their detriment.
Yeah, I think you've got to remember as well, like the example you just used. I remember that game, which Hernandez scored at the end. But you're talking about Sir Alex Ferguson's Man United. Best manager of all time. He was the best at coming away from a philosophy and tweaking something if he thought he had to. Like, he always used to put an extra midfielder in against Arsenal, didn't he? And stuff like that. If he went away in Europe, he'd play slightly different. If they were playing Barcelona, he'd maybe come up with a different plan. And he wasn't too proud to come away from being, we're Man United and we're going to play like this, if he felt like he needed to change things and that would get a better outcome. And I think there's something to be learnt there, probably, from managers maybe like Big Ange, maybe like Russell Martin, who are so sort of full on in their principles. But it's easier said than done, isn't it? Because as soon as you do come away from your principles and you change something for a game and it doesn't work, everyone's saying, oh, he's lost it now. He's completely gone away from what he thought and he's now losing games playing someone else's kind of football. So I can see why people would rather, managers would probably rather die on their sword, so to speak, rather than tinker with something and still lose anyway. For instance, if Southampton are playing Manchester City, they're losing that game regardless. So you might as well go out and use it as an opportunity to play and die on your sword rather than dying on someone else's. But I remember that Valencia away game very well with Hernandez at the end.
That Man City Southampton thing's just reminded me that Pep sometimes, like when they've not played that well, will like make like a outlandish statement like, oh, that was our best performance of the season by far. And you just know it's not. He, after the Southampton game, was really like patronised and said, I will learn so, so much from Russell Martin. And they've gone on to lose their next three games. It's like, yeah, you've learned plenty from young Russell Pep. Boys, just want to look ahead to the weekend. We've obviously touched on the fact that you've got Brighton, Man City and Chelsea, Arsenal. But Lauren, Liverpool versus Villa this weekend. Liverpool turned it on in the second half against Leverkusen, Xabi Alonso's Leverkusen with a Luis Diaz hat-trick. And Aston Villa, their form actually isn't great. They lost in Europe in midweek. If you've not seen the goal, I implore you to look at it. Tyrone Mings just picking up a goal kick from Emi Martinez and conceding the penalty. They got hammered by Tottenham that we touched on. They're out the EFL Cup after losing at Palace and draw against Bournemouth. So Liverpool maybe have one eye on extending that lead even further at the top with some tricky fixtures for City and Arsenal.
Yeah, I would heavily fancy Liverpool in that game. A, because they've won every game this season, bar Forest, I think. Or maybe a couple of draws in there as well. But B, because Aston Villa are coming off that tonking at Spurs. I can imagine that they're probably thinking, let's try and get out of here with a point. And I don't think they're going to be overly expansive. And I don't think it's going to be a particularly end-to-end game. I think it will be very much Liverpool dominant. And Villa will probably try and get out of there with anything. But on the flip side of that, if Villa go to Anfield and win at the weekend, I think they're title contenders. So have that.
Do you know what? Villa have lost their last three games. And it's interesting. We talk about Unai Emery potentially like, and it sounds really patronising, but like making a step up to like these massive giant clubs. But, and I know he's done an unbelievable job, but like if he had lost three games in a row at, say, Man United or at Arsenal, it would be much bigger news than at Villa. And maybe that's why he's such a perfect fit for Villa.
But the context of that is he's Aston Villa manager. Do you know what I mean? He isn't Man United. The reason there's a lot more pressure, there's a lot more eyes on it if you lose three games in a row at Man United is because they're the biggest club in the world. Do you know what I mean? Or if you did it at Liverpool or Man City, it takes you out the title race. Aston Villa are a team coming from the Championship, nearly getting relegated under Steven Gerrard. In comes Emery, and now a Champions League team who we're actually talking about, could they go one step further? So I think probably context is key in that regard.
Yeah.
But his history does tell you that he does very well at those Aston Villa type level teams, doesn't it? Like he won the Europa League with Sevilla, didn't he? 20 times. So maybe.
An interesting thing I've noticed with Villa over the last couple of weeks is that he's been trying to sort of blood in Duran and Watkins playing together and it actually hasn't worked. Obviously, they've lost the last three games. And I wonder how that dynamic will continue because obviously Watkins does an unbelievable job for the team. And over the last, 18 months, he's basically scored the goals to warrant that as well. But Duran's knocking on the door and he keeps knocking on the door and it'll be difficult to keep Duran happy. He's somewhat of a controversial figure after videoing himself on Instagram Live in the summer, putting up the Hammers sign because he wanted to move to West Ham. And obviously January transfer window's around the corner. So you can see if he doesn't get in the team between now and then, maybe he kicks up a stink a little bit, you never know. But that dynamic between Duran and Watkins is something to watch out for, because it's sort of coincided a little bit with them losing a couple games.
Yeah, and how that plays out is one of them has to go, because we see it time and time again. And just teams like, for instance, at Tottenham, they can't have another really good striker because they know they're not going to play every week because Harry Kane was there for so long. And it's that second striker syndrome. And I think Duran's thinking to himself now, I'm ready to go and be the number one somewhere, which he probably would be at somewhere like West Ham. So it will have to go. And Unai Emery does need to be careful there, because literally in the context of Aston Villa, do you remember when Dean Smith tried to play, he bought Danny Ings and tried to play those two up front, completely destroyed everything. And he ended up getting himself sacked literally because of that. Destroyed the whole dynamic of the team and the way that they play, because he wanted to play both of them. So he can't afford to do that, and I don't think he will. You know, I mean, I think, like you said, Duran's been a little bit controversial with some of the stuff that he's done. He got taken off midweek a couple of weeks ago, and like, I think threw his toys out the pram on the sidelines a little bit. So I would imagine that will culminate in Duran moving on for probably good big money.
One other thing I just wanted to touch on as well is obviously the Arsenal-Chelsea game at the weekend as well. I think massive game for Arsenal, as we've touched on earlier in the pod. Declan Rice apparently got a broken toe, but willing to get injections in it to play through the pain before the international break to get through that game. But I think probably not must win for Arsenal, but getting as close to that in the title race. And you might think they'd potentially have the edge with Chelsea playing on Thursday, but I think Chelsea won 8-0 last night against some team from Armenia called Noah. And I think they had a couple bloody Chelsea pensioners up top, Jeremy Clarkson in goal and Spencer Matthews in the hole. So that shows you what squad they're putting out for that.
If I was Arteta, I'd tell Declan and Rice not to bother.
What, have the game on?
I'd generally tell Declan and Rice not to bother getting the injection. Yeah, generally, I think he's been quite poor this season, Declan Rice, and I don't know whether he's been carrying a couple of injuries. And it's so funny, this time last year, we're all talking about Caicedo being an overpriced flop and Declan Rice being well worth the money. And this season, it's like roles reversed. And I don't feel, my personal opinion is that neither player was worth 100 million, but Caicedo has been unbelievable for Chelsea this season. And I don't think Declan Rice has hit the level that he hit last season.
How back is Odegaard, Tomo, by the way, in regards to fitness? Like, did he get any minutes in Milan at all, or anything at all? Like, do we know how, like, is he like likely to be in on Sunday? Or do you think they're looking at him more post-international break?
I'd be shocked if he started on Sunday, and I think maybe he's probably ready for 15 minutes, but yeah, if I was, given the context that they are struggling a little bit, so maybe he might be rushed back, but if I was Arteta, I'd give him the international break to come back, to build up that fitness and sharpness, etc. But they do need him.
I mean, if they're Odegaardless and Riceless, what's their midfield at Chelsea? Partey, Marino and Havertz, or Jorginho? I think they could become unstuck at Stamford Bridge there. I think Palmer, Caicedo and Lavia could run riot against that. I worry for Arsenal at the weekend. I really do. But we will see. And they say Brighton City as well. So some massive, massive games this weekend in the Prem. And obviously next pod we'll cover how they all get on. Boys, let's move on to the EFL. Excited to talk about this. Want to start at Coventry. Lauro, obviously news broke earlier in the week of the decision for Coventry, had sacked Mark Robbins, manager who's obviously got them to playoff finals, a fingernail away offside from coming back from 3-0 in the FA Cup semi-final against Man United and winning 4-3 and possibly giving Coventry fans one of the best days of their life. Just want your opinion on that decision to sack him.
Well, I think it speaks volumes for the job that he's done there. That, I mean, I'm not a Coventry City fan. I'm a neutral in regards to them. But I feel like I know an awful lot about them because they've been really hard to ignore over the last 7 years, which is the tenure in which Mark Robbins has presided over. And when you think about bringing in a manager and what you want from them, what Coventry's hierarchy have got from Mark Robbins is him picking them up in League Two, getting promoted out of League Two, winning League One, playing their home games at St Andrews because they didn't have a stadium, establishing themselves as a championship team, getting to the playoff final and losing on penalties, getting to the FA Cup semi-final and losing out on a drastic offside decision against Man United, and being one of the most watchable and enjoyable and probably exciting neutral teams in the country. And if you had said to someone 7 years ago, Mark Robbins is going to deliver you that, and you're currently sitting 7 points off the playoffs in the Championship, as a Coventry City fan, what are your thoughts? You'd be over the moon and thinking, I hope he's on a 10-year contract. And if you said to them, you're going to be sacked off the back of all of that over 7 years, you'd be saying, who on earth is making that decision? Because they're out of their mind. And then you think, well, Mark Robbins is maybe more of an old school coach. Is it because he's maybe not up to or in the same vein of some of the more trendy managers, and he's not bringing players on the same way? So you think about the players that he's coached. Victor Gyökeres, who he brought in from Brighton that nobody knew, who Swansea couldn't get a tune out of on loan. He's now quite literally one of the best strikers in Europe. Gus Hamer, who no one knew, now the best player in the Championship. Callum O'Hare, one of the most exciting players in the Championship. Hadji Wright, he's doing it again, currently at Coventry. Look back to League Two. He plucked Mark McNulty out of Sheffield United, who no one knew, scored 23 in 40 games, got him promoted, sold him to Reading for £1 million, never seen again, never scored another goal. So his track record of improving players as a manager is fantastic as well. So all of this stuff combined, and I've looked at the Coventry City fans' reactions. I listened to the Coventry pod yesterday that the fans do. They're all sick as parrots. I think that is one of the worst managerial sackings I've ever seen, ever. And, you know, I don't wish bad upon any football club. And obviously, I hope for Coventry City fans' sake it's not the case. But it wouldn't bother me seeing them getting relegated now off the back of a disloyal kind of reactive sacking like that. Coventry City, by the way, on Saturday went to Middlesbrough and won 3-0 at Michael Carrick's Middlesbrough that everyone thinks is fantastic. I think it's so difficult to explain. And it's just one of those that pop out at you. It's not one that you think, oh, that's surprising, but fair enough. I think it's an absolute disgrace. Two promotions, FA Cup semi-final, penalty kicks away from Wembley. All of these fantastic players, some of the best players the Championship's seen, 7 points off the playoffs right now. Sacked. I mean, unpick that.
Tom, I'll let you try.
I think Laura's done a really good job, a stellar job of describing the emotions of most of Coventry fans and most of football fans. I when I found out the news, I obviously posted it on Football Tweet, and I just ended the tweet with "game's gone." And there's been many occasions over the last years where I felt like the game's gone. But Mark Robbins at Coventry felt like kind of like it just was one of those good football stories that harked back to sort of 15, 20 years ago, where managers actually were given time and patience and respect, basically. And obviously, and the thing is as well, I've listened to the Coventry owner a couple of times come on Talk Sport and talk to Simon Jordan and Jim White, and he's always sounded like a really reasonable, astute business bloke. But it this decision sort of makes all of those sort of points that I just made go out the window. And it's just sad, really. And I'm not a Coventry fan. And obviously I was, as a Man United fan, one of the beneficiaries of that offside call last year. But yeah, if I was a Coventry fan, I'd be absolutely devastated. It would almost feel like a death in the family.
And you think, like, we talk about, like, why isn't there a really good kind of batch or group or assembly of young British coaches getting into the game? Mark Robbins is a fantastic English coach. But why, who on earth would want to be a manager if that's how you get treated? You can go into a club, take him from League Two to the Championship, bring through all these brilliant players, have brilliant days out at Wembley, and the first time you start the season a little bit poorly, you're going to get the boot. Why would anyone bother with that? It's absolutely disgusting. And that is why, and I've said this before, I think I said this when Mark Bonner was on, Mark Robbins could have gone to Middlesbrough a couple of years ago, turned it down, no, we'll stay at Coventry, signed a new deal. And when managers do jump ship, they quite often get a lot of criticism. But why would you? Why should they show any loyalty? If a bigger or better club with more prospects come in, for Mark Robbins, who might have a little bit more chance of getting to the Premier League, why wouldn't he jump ship? Why wouldn't anyone look at that and think, next time I get a better offer, I'm going? Because you never know how long you're going to get from your current owners. There's no loyalty in football at all. And I think, what's his name? Is it Doug King, is it? The Coventry owner? I think he's a disgrace.
Well, well said. So, Mark Robbins leaves. He was in charge for 7 years. That left him second in the longest serving managers across the 92 clubs. There's someone in first place who has been at their club for 15 years, but they have been in non-league during that time. Could either of you tell me who that is?
The Harrogate manager.
Yeah, Simon Weaver. Now, tell me who is now number two. They are in the Premier League and they've been at the club for 8 years and 129 days.
Pep.
Yeah, it is. Pep's now the longest serving consistent manager in the 92 because obviously Harrogate come up from non-league. You've actually got three Prem managers in a row then. Thomas Frank in third, 6 years and 22 days. And then Mikel Arteta in fourth, 4 years, 321 days. So just coming up to his 5 year anniversary. That kind of goes to show, doesn't it? Not too much loyalty in football there when in fourth place in the list is someone who's under 5 years. So I think it's a very good point, Laura, about if a big club comes, why should they show that loyalty?
Like also as well, just quickly, like Coventry have gone in now for Matt Bloomfield at Wickham. He's the lad that took over from Gareth Ainsworth at Wickham and he's doing a really good job. He's been there, what, a year and a half, something like that now. They're top of the league. Birmingham have got a game in hand. They're doing a brilliant job, right? But he's only been a manager for a year. How on earth can you... You've got a manager here who's got 7 years at your club and his trajectory is only up. Only up. The next thing that's going to happen to Coventry City under Mark Robbins is get promoted. There's no chance of relegation. To chuck all that away to go for a younger manager in League One who's had, what, 10 successful games now in a run that's taken them to the top of the league... I just think it's unbelievable. But on the point of why wouldn't you jump ship, I'm sure Matt Bloomfield will at Wickham and he'll go and take the money that Coventry offer him and fair play to him. It's not his fault. But I'm not sure that's the right fit, to be honest with you.
I wondered how many instances there are where like a manager like that gets sacked and then it's like they bring in the new person and then that goes peaked on quite quickly and they're like, oh shit, we realise what we've done here. And then like maybe Mark Robbins by this time next year is already back in at Coventry and everyone's like, that was a bit of a mad period where you sacked him off for 6 months. It wouldn't surprise me if he don't get offered another championship team this season, which I'm sure he will, it wouldn't surprise me to see him back at Coventry in the not too distant future if it doesn't go well for Matt Bloomfield.
Well, just on that point, I remember Mick Beale last year, was it last season or the season before where he basically chose to stay at QPR because Wolves coming for him and then he left straight away for Rangers coming in for him. And he was the sort of the laughing stock of talk sport and football fans because he was derided heavily criticised and maybe rightly so. But his defence is he could just take this Mark Robbins case and just say, well, look how managers get treated. So why should I treat clubs any differently to the way that clubs treat managers?
No, definitely. Good point. So wider EFL, Laura, I just want to touch on the midweek action. Millwall obviously been in good form. Leeds went to them. Wrong side for Leeds on a 1-0 loss.
Yeah. I mean, typical championship game. There's a pattern to Leeds' game and that pattern is that we're the best side by a mile, have lots and lots of the ball, and obviously if we don't take our chances then we get punished, but that's football, isn't it? But I stick to the fact that Leeds are the best side I've seen in the championship and they'll be winning the league, and you can come back and play the three or four times I've said that this season already to me at the end of the season if I'm wrong, but we will be winning the league. And I think the fact that Millwall, I think they're in the playoffs now, with the side that they've got, shows the level of the championship this year is actually, I think, significantly lower than it's been for the last 3 or 4 years. And it shows that there's a chance for probably quite a lot of teams that have been in and around knocking on the door maybe the last 5, 6 years, like a Millwall or like a Bristol City, to get in there this year and give themselves a chance of doing a Luton or a Brentford, because it doesn't come around that often. So I think it's exciting for those teams. But I mean, I'm sure you come on to it, but Sunderland... I think, drew at Preston, didn't they? I think you'll see them tear off pretty soon. I don't think they're going to be in the title race come after Christmas. I think they'll be more of a playoff team. And I don't really see where much of a challenge is going to come from.
Just on Millwall, because not a team that we've spoken too much about on the pod. They've won their last four games 1-0. They beat Leeds, beat Burnley, went away to Swansea and won 1-0, and beat Plymouth 1-0 as well. So they're slowly creeping up into playoff contention, as you say. And yeah, Sunderland drew 0-0 at Preston. I think Sheffield United, who are in second, they needed a 98th minute winner away at Bristol City. So yeah, it is tight at the top. One team I just want to briefly call out, or one fan base I want to call out, is the West Brom fan base. I shared with you guys earlier their recent run of form. They've not won now in 8 games, 2 losses, and then they've had 6 draws since then, of which 4 have been 0-0 and 2 1-1 draws against Luton and Oxford. And in their games at the Hawthorns so far this season, they've only been 3 goals scored. We've had 4 0-0s, 3 1-0s. 2 of them they've won with goals from Josh Mazur in one and Jason Malumbi in the other. And the only other person to score at the Hawthorns is Hayden Hackney for Middlesbrough on the 1st of October. And the last time a goal was scored there is 37 days ago. So if you're a West Brom season ticket holder and you've seen your team score twice at home all season in the league, I can only apologise for you and how difficult that must be to watch. That is a minging run of form, and 6 draws in a row is just awful, especially with them 0-0s and 1-0s. Terrible.
Can I just make a point? Can I just make a point about Millwall and Neil Harris, actually? And it kind of links into the Mark Robbins decision. And it, obviously, Neil Harris has been there before and done a good job. And he's come back in and he's obviously doing a brilliant job now. I know it might be a moment in time, but sometimes in life and in football, you get these managers that just fit clubs. Do you know what I mean? And yeah. Mark Robbins, and he clearly fits Millwall and he's doing a great job. And like, his personality suits that club, the fan base, all of it. Everyone goes together. And Mark Robbins obviously was a massive example of that in Coventry. And yeah, I know, not to labour the point, but it's just such a shame that they've not realised that they've not got like a almost like Mark Robbins is almost like the Sir Alex Ferguson of Coventry. And they could have just carried going. They could have carried it going and sort of backed him to get them out of that. Well, they're not even in that much trouble. Like Laura says, they're only 7 points off the playoffs. But yeah, anyway, fair play to Millwall and fair play to Neil Harris.
What was Neil Harris's career path then, Laura? He was at Millwall, wasn't he? And then he spent some time, was he at Gillingham and for a bit?
No. This time last season, he was at Gillingham getting sacked in League 2. And then everyone was like, hang on a minute, Neil Harris has just got a job at Cambridge in League 1. He's got sacked and he's gone up a league to League 1. And then Millwall needed a manager and he's gone and found himself in the Championship. And then 6 months later, they're in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And like you said, you're right, Tiga. Like sometimes the commentary fans were saying yesterday, literally exactly what you just said. Like we were the cheat code. We found that manager that fit with the club and that everyone liked and actually was able to work with everyone and actually get the most out of a club that is probably overachieving every single year. Even when they had all the off-the-pitch problems, even when they had to play at Birmingham City, even when they had to play their first 10 league games away from home. And they said, now we've chucked that all away for that constant 2-year cycle of a new manager, which most Championship clubs have.
Mm.
It must be so depressing for them, because they must have been sat there thinking, God, we are the envy of a lot of these teams here, because we've got our feet under the table with a proper machine. With a manager at the helm that everyone respects and a massive track record of not only promotions, but bringing on massive, massive player improvement. Just look at Victor Gyökeres. I mean, I know that's an obvious thing to say, but it's not just him. It's so many others. Honestly, I can't tell you how bad that is, not just for Coventry, but just for football and managers in general. It's such a crap one.
And quite an intangible quality in a manager is sort of their connection to the fans. And almost like you're taking this community, this football club, and these thousands of people who support this football club, whose sort of their weekends and their mood depends on whether you win or lose. And it quite often feels quite transactional in terms of, well, if you lose, I'm annoyed. If you win, I'm happy. Whereas, like, you get that lightning in a bottle where you get this manager who it makes you feel like you're part of something. It makes you feel like you're greater than just, you're part of something greater than just the result on the weekend. And then you go ahead and sack him. It's like, well, Coventry fans know it better than me. Now we're back on that, like Laura said, 2-year cycle or 18 month cycle of trying to find it again. And they found it after probably 25, 30 years of the last time they had it. And It's a shame. And I know we've laboured on the point, but it's such a shame. And
I'm going to labour slightly more, because what you just said is absolutely right. Like, supporting a football team is so much better when you have that connection with, like, the players, and that comes from the manager with recruitment and the style of play and all that and the results and that sort of thing. And Leeds had it with Bielsa, and I remember, like, when Leeds were, like, at the top of the league with Bielsa, like, you were so involved and integrated in it. It felt like amazing every week to be a Leeds United fan. And you compare, even when we went up to the Premier League, if we went 3-0 down, it was like, I don't think we're out of this. Like, it's so rare to get, like, a manager that you trust and love that so much and don't want to be sacked. And even now, like, in the Championship, we've got Daniel Farke, who's doing a really good job. And you see it all the time. There's so many Leeds fans that are there like, I wouldn't mind if he was sacked, to be honest with you. I don't feel that kind of same buzz. It's not the same as it was with Bielsa. And it's not always going to be like that. But when you find that manager, bloody hell, look after it. They should be offering Mark Robbins a lifetime contract, not sacking him. So another good point.
Right, I've got to move on from Mark Robbins. Weekend fixtures coming up in the Championship. Coventry, they go to Sunderland. Mark Robbins-less Coventry go to Sunderland. Leeds host QPR. Millwall go to Stoke, who are obviously flying. And then on Sunday, you've got the, is it Steel City Derby? Is that what it's called? The Sheffield Derby. In Sheffield United versus Sheffield Wednesday, West Brom go to Hull in a 0-0 draw, and Burnley host Swansea. So some big games coming up in the Championship as well for the top teams, most probably importantly that Steel City derby. So we will bring you all up to speed with that next week as well. Laurie, just want to move on and touch on Yeovil to close off. Had a weekend off last week with the FA Cup fixtures of Yeovil being out. But a trip to Essex for you this weekend.
Yeah, I've been to Rootsall a couple of times. It's a good place to go. They get the most fans in the league, Southend, I think, like 7,000 weekly, which unbelievable, by the way, in the fifth tier of English football. But Yeovil were in really, really good form. We're in the playoffs, and it's just so annoying that we've got to go and play a game like that tomorrow with loads of suspensions and injuries. Like, Aaron Jarvis, Dom Bernard, Morgan Williams are all suspended. Matt Worthington and Michael Smith are both injured. They're five of our, like, key players, and none of them are going to be playing tomorrow. Like, next week we'll have a couple back from suspension, etc. It's just this one game. It's, if any Southend fans are listening, it's such an amazing time to play us, and that you've got to support your team on the good days and the bad days. So I am going to Southend tomorrow, but I'm not expecting an awful lot. And if we win it, it will be one of the best wins I've ever seen as a Yeovil fan, probably, because we are down to the bare bones, really. And the personnel that are out sort of dictate the formation as well. A couple of really key centre-backs are out. Our number nine's out. So I'm not expecting too much. And it's probably one that, we'd snap your hand off for a point. But I will be at Rootsall tomorrow supporting the Glovers onto hopefully victory, but probably one to forget.
Well, on that note, we will finish up. Boys, we'll be back next week where we will review all of the weekend action, and we will probably look ahead to some of the England games in the international break. But cheers, boys. Pleasure as always.
Well done. 1, 2, 3.